The Path to Authenticity is brought to you by GIA Miami. Founded by world-class mental health experts, GIA provides advanced care for difficult-to-treat conditions, including anxiety, medication-resistant depression, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. Using state-of-the-art methods, GIA can help people recover from conditions when more traditional approaches can't. Dr. Antonello Bonci has assembled an expert team serving international clientele in a modern and resplendent Miami setting. If you or someone you love is suffering from depression, anxiety, OCD, or other mental health concerns, call GIA at 833-713-0828. You can learn more about GIA by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting GIAMiami.com.
Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
This is John Thomas, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 179 for June 14th, 2022. And this is a conversation I pulled out from the archives. Features my friend John Thomas, who's the publisher of Psychology Today magazine. And this one is pretty special to me because John is someone who I met over the course of my career and sort of befriended, and I've reached out to him from time to time. I've confided in him about some of my aspirations, including this podcast. And when I finished the first episode and released it, I sent it to him. And, you know, the publisher of Psychology Today, John's a pretty busy guy, but he took the time to listen to it. And he took the time to give me feedback. And, you know, I was really excited about the guest. It was my first conversation with Lucia Capicchioni, the first one we recorded anyway. And he basically said, yeah, she was great, but also you were great. So to get that kind of feedback from somebody who's done really well for himself in the media just meant a whole lot to me. So this conversation was originally in episode 12. And next week I'll share the second half, which was originally in episode 14. So here you go, John Thomas.
You?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this, and I've been looking forward to talking to you.
My pleasure. I've been looking forward to it as well.
Good, good. Well, for the listeners, can you just tell them what it is that you do for a living, and we can kind of go from there?
Sure. I am the publisher and executive vice president of Psychology Today and psychologytoday.com. And for listeners who may not know what a publisher does, It's kind of like if it were in the movie business, it's a director would be the editor in chief, and the producer would be the equivalent to, or the executive producer would be the equivalent to the publisher. The publishing side of media is really the glorious or dirty revenue, whichever way you want to look at it.
Yeah.
Side of the business, and other things too. It's the marketing arm of media.
So how long have you been there, John?
I've been at Psychology Today. It will be 11 years in the fall. I came here in the fall of 2008.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so was this, did you come in as the publisher?
No, I began as, I think, when I first started, I came in as the director of advertising.
Okay.
For the magazine and the website. And within a really short period of time, I became the associate publisher. And within another year or two, a year, maybe a year and a half, I became the publisher.
Wow. So what were you doing before, John?
Oh my goodness. My career in media has, been going on for quite a while. Do you want to?
Longer than you would like to say.
Longer than I would like to. Actually, someone referred to me and they thought they, you know, they were kind of joking, but they referred to me. They used me and dinosaur in the same sentence today.
Gosh.
And they
was
thought
it?
That was hysterical. And I wanted to punched them in the face.
I bet
in the
you
face
did.
Is my right, and I think they were joking. I hope they were, but I don't think it's all.
Well, let's start. Let's go back a little further. Where'd you grow up?
I am from Texas. I am from a little town that's not so little anymore called Denton, Texas.
Okay,
which is a town directly north by about 40 miles of Dallas and Fort Worth.
Okay. All right. And,
and it was a sweet, great little town. During my childhood, my mother's family, from there and has been there for just generations. Are a big part of that community, her family.
Okay.
And it was a great place to grow up. It's grown tremendously since I was little. And as I say to my siblings, when I go back, you know, it's kind of charm free now. I mean, there were great, you know, things about a small Texas town that, once it becomes, you know, you see stores that you see everywhere around the country and gone are the, I don't know, Piggly Wigglies.
Right.
And they're replaced with, you know, big,
just more commercialized.
You know, yeah. Big box stores and Applebee's and all that stuff. It kind of loses its wonderful appeal.
Yeah. Well, so.
But I had it. I was able to enjoy that, growing up there.
And then, so you left, I assume, for college?
Yeah, I went to school in Texas, and then immediately after college, moved to New York, without a real plan. I just knew I wanted to work in media, specifically advertising was my, so I was a journalist. Major. It was a double major, English and journalism. So knew that I really wanted a career in advertising, like a lot of young people do. Mm-hmm. I mean, and in my mind, advertising was like Darren Stevens from The Witch. Does that reference make any sense to you?
It right? does to me, but it may not. It may not it may to anyone not. Younger than me.
I hope the reruns will serve. For that reference. But that was, you know, and funnily enough, it's something I knew even as a little boy. Like I kind of knew how advertising worked, and I knew that that was something that combined a lot of different elements of things that you know I enjoyed. Whether it was, you know, knowing I would probably be good at business, and there was also a kind of a exciting theatrical showbiz part to advertising, right?
Yeah.
And there's music, and there's, you know, sexiness, and I mean that in the market. I mean that in a lot of different ways, but really in the marketing sense of that word. Mm-hmm. And so it had, like for a lot of young people, it had its this appeal that I knew I could somehow, you know, fit into that world. And so I moved to New York right after college and got a job at Doubleday Publishing, not wanting to work for Doubleday especially, but they had their own in-house media department, their own in-house agency.
Okay.
And so I became a media planner. And it was really crunching numbers, and it wasn't this Darren Stevens life that I had kind of longed for and dreamt about and anticipated. It was crunching numbers, and I really don't like crunching numbers at all. But while I was doing that job, I would have these meetings. These people would come in from magazines, and they were super nice and super slick, and they looked like they just had the best time, and they would take me out to lunch at great places, and as it turns out, they were advertising account executives.
Right.
These, you know, every magazine under the sun would come in to Doubleday but to sell me advertising for the Doubleday book clubs,
mm-hmm.
which were like the names of the book clubs were things like Ecstasy Romance and Military Book Club and one. There were like 10 different book clubs at Doubleday. So that was my job. And I thought when I would be around these people, I thought, you know what? I can do this. I can do what they do. And that really launched, being around those guys, seeing them, hearing them, and identifying with what they were doing, really set me on my path. And I was super, super lucky that, my first job was actually at Rolling Stone.
Wow.
And this was in 1989, I guess, maybe 88, when Rolling Stone was at its height. I mean, it really was at the pinnacle of its, you know, bigness and its success, and nothing was better. Nothing was more brilliant.
Yeah, it was before Spin.
Well, Spin actually plays a part in this story because I'll get into that. But way before Spin. So I started at Rolling Stone, and it was a really tough job to get. I was just a kid, and they were talking to, there was an opening there, in their advertising department, and they were talking to people. I remember all this like it was yesterday, because I still look back and think, you know, I really was at the right place at the right time, surrounded by the right people. They were talking to people from GQ and from Esquire, from all of these, you know, big deal magazines, these people that were established. And so that was my competition. I was this kid, and I really gave it my all and did great at the interviews, did terrifically well until the very last interview. And I really went in, this is a lesson from my life. I went in, I'd done so well with these interviews, and I gained this false sense of security about it. Like, oh, I've got it. It's in the bag. I'm going to get this. I'm this young guy, but I'm going to get this. And I didn't fully prepare for this one last presentation I had to do for them. Because again, at this time in the magazine world was really different than it is now. It was at its height. It was extremely competitive. Magazine jobs were coveted. And the best of the best were, you know, out there vying for these positions. And I went in for this last presentation, and I was not as prepared as I should have been, and I blew it. When I say blew it, I mean totally blew it. I became a nervous wreck. I was sweating. I couldn't put a sentence together. They literally stopped me in the middle of it, because I think I was making them nervous, and they got me a water and a napkin to wipe my sweaty brow.
Oh, it was
horrible. Now you can imagine my devastation of being up on, you know, cloud nine, thinking I'm like a shoo-in for this thing because I'd done so well, and then going in and really blowing it. Mm-hmm. That night I went home to my little apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And in my devastation, what am I going to do? And I was taking out a contact lens out of my eye. And to make matters worse than they already were, the contact lens fell into the toilet. Now, this story is literally going somewhere.
Okay.
It becomes this magical moment of redemption. So my contact lens falls into the toilet, and I think, this can't get worse. I blew this opportunity. I'm going to have to go back to this job. I can't stand it at Doubleday, crunching numbers. I just, you know, this is not a good scene. And I look down, and this contact lens is floating on the very edge of the water. It had not gone down the, you know, the drain, so to speak. It was there. I could salvage it. I grabbed that thing out of the toilet, literally, washed it off completely, put it back in my eye, stayed up all night long, and redid this presentation. And I remember the presentation too completely. I did this thing where the market of Rolling Stone delivers you the entire pie, not just one slice of it, where the Rolling Stone audience was men and women and the full complexion of a complete demographic that any advertiser would want. I stayed up all night long and did it. Went to an all night bakery in Grand Central Station and got an actual pie and delivered it, you know, unannounced to the doorstep of Rolling Stone the next morning. Left it there with a presentation that I'd worked on all night long. Left it there and went to my job. And I did that not thinking, okay, this is going to get me this is going to undo, you know, my horrible performance at the final presentation, but at least they're going to know that I'm not some loser who just gave up and whimpered away and into the background. I wanted to show them at least that I cared enough about it and about them and about myself to give it, you know, to show them what I was really made of. But I had zero expectation that anything would come of it. And so later that day, I got a call in my office or my little cubicle in the Doubleday Media Department. And it was Dana Fields, who at that time was the associate publisher of Rolling Stone and a remarkable woman, incredible. And, she said, can you come in just to talk to me for a minute? I got your thing. And she wasn't, you know, effusive, and she wasn't like, oh my God, that was so great of you or whatever. She was just like, just stop by if you can. And so I thought, okay, well, that's awfully nice. And I went by during my lunch hour, and it was, Dana and then, her her cohort, a guy by the name of Les Siphon, who was another associate publisher there. And they sat me down, and they were the ones that I had done the presentations for in the first place, and it had all the great buildup with, and then finally the big, you know, horrible performance in front of. They sat me down, and they took me through this presentation, and they did a brilliant job, and they performed beautifully, and I was just riveted. And they looked at me, and Dana said, "Do you think that you'd ever be able to do that?" And I go, "Well, I'm not really sure." And then she stopped me and she leaned over and she said, "Well, I think you can. And you are hired."
Wow.
And I'm telling you, that little contact lens had not fallen out into that toilet. And I'm not even joking about that. Yeah. It's the truth. That was his sign I had that don't give up.
Right.
Don't give up at this, you know,
you could have just flushed the toilet.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
No more contact lens.
No more contact lens. And I would have just gone to bed or done, you know, and wallowed and, you know, whatever. But I didn't. I saw it. I grabbed it. I stuck it in my eye, stayed up all night. And I'm glad it all happened that way. I'm glad that I kind of, you know, screwed up that final presentation, and then then the next 24 hours changed everything for me, changed the way I thought about myself,
mm-hmm.
and the way I thought about challenging myself. And I wasn't surrounded by a lot of family and friends because they were all back in Texas, and I was, you know, here, you know, with new friends for sure, but really, you know, not the.
Yeah, you were doing it on your own.
The lifelong heart, you know, yeah. friends of my heart that I had known my entire life. So I was really, you know, in this, you know, position of sink or swim. Mm. And I'm glad that I, you know, had that moment of redemption.
Wow, that's a cool story. So
it's a good story. It's a good story, and I say that because I'm really glad it happened to me. I'm super grateful for that. I'm very, and it informed so much of things that happened ever since. Mm-hmm. Because we all are faced with adversity, and not just something as the bigger things than that have happened to me.
Yeah.
You know, much, 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 much bigger things than that have happened. But that really informed so much of, you know, as a young man, how I learned to approach things.
Yeah. Tenacity. And, you know, you mentioned that you showed them that you cared.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
maybe not a lot of people would have approached it that way and gone back, you know? With no expectations.
I don't know. I mean, the only thing that kind of informs that for me, it's interesting that you say that, because I've often thought, well, maybe a lot of people would have done, maybe it wasn't that extraordinary. Maybe a lot of people would have done the same thing. Maybe a lot of people, first of all, would have been prepared in the first place and wouldn't have been in that position, number one. Mm-hmm. But if they were, maybe they would all stay up all night and redo it. Now that, you know, I'm the boss and people come in and present to me or, you know, whatever, very few, if any, have, you know, after they have not done great, have turned around and wowed me by right. surprise yeah. the next day. Very few.
Yeah.
In fact, none.
Hmm. Well, you know, impressions are huge too. They really are. You know, I think about there was a time when I was young and I had first moved to Florida here, and, you know, I wanted to learn more about art, and, you know, I decided I wanted to get a job at an art gallery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that world in Palm Beach, it's small, you know, it's not New York, but it's pretty competitive, and there's some really nice galleries.
Maybe even more competitive than New York. Yeah. New York has a broader spectrum, but in Palm Beach is so rarefied, that world, and they all know each other.
It's yes.
very
yes.
It's a small you know, tribe.
Yeah. And it was heading into the season and they needed help. And, you know, I kept showing up there and calling. And, you know, this office manager kept telling me, well, I have several other applicants I have to interview. And then finally one day I called her and she said, well, you keep calling and showing up. So I guess, you know, I might as well just go ahead and give you the job.
John, let me ask you, had you done any, had you worked at a gallery before? Or was this just your young man's head going, wait, this is something I think I want to do?
No, you know, well, back in my past life, I was a carpenter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I was young, just out of high school, a couple years later, I joined the Carpenters Union and I did that for several years. So I learned a lot about that, and it was a not maintenance as much as installations, shipping, but you know, you ship a monumental sculpture, you got to build a big crate and, right. And you know, you have to know really, if you're going to hang an entire gallery of art, you need to know how to hang artwork. And, so I knew I could do it and I wanted to learn about art more. You know, I'd taken some art history in college and I've always loved art. So yeah, it was the kind of thing where, I mean, it was probably the best gallery over there at the time. And, you know, I don't know how well you know art, but, you know, there were, I mean, Hans Hoffman and, you know, Dubuffet and you name it, really. I mean, there were Picassos that I handled. And, but, you know, a lot of the artists that aren't anywhere near as familiar as a Picasso.
My great uncle, as an aside, you asked me how much I know. I maybe know more than the average bear. My great uncle, who it was, he's dead now, but a world renowned abstract expressionist, studied with Hans Hoffman. So I know all about
who was it? Do tell.
His name is Myron Stout. And, okay. You can look him up and get a more succinct kind of profile on his work. He was remarkable, and MoMA has his work, the Guggenheim, the Whitney, and he's represented, I think, still by Joan Washburn.
Wow.
So I have a real appreciation for that, and also an understanding how the art world works, mm-hmm. and which I think a lot of people would be surprised at how all of that. It's really it's a tricky business.
Mm-hmm. Is it Stout?
Uh-huh.
Okay. I, you know, at my desk, I have a big copy of, I'm sure you've seen it before, The Art Book. You know what I'm talking about?
I have it in my office. Yeah. I actually have one in my office somewhere.
I pulled it out to see if he's in there, but he's not, you know. But right. When I had that job, you know, what I did is I bought the smaller, there's a pocket version of that. And if you're not familiar with this book, it basically has a good example of lots of different artists. It's in one good example for you know,
right.
All through the alphabet. But it enabled me to, you know, work in this gallery, and the owner could come in and say, you know, I want the Hoffman over there. And I would know what he was talking about, and got to the point where, you know, I could recognize a lot of different artists. And I really, yeah, I love that. That was a good experience for me. It didn't last terribly long. It was shortly before I got into the addiction treatment industry. But it was a cool experience, and
yeah, something I think unless you're the gallery owner or the representative, that it also in terms of money that you can make can be, that can be challenging.
Yeah.
If you're on the periphery of that business.
Well, and maybe sales in some cases, but, you know, I mean, they're high end pieces and, you know, every sale's a really big sale and
every sale's a really big sale. And so again, if you're a commissioned salesperson, but really the gallery owner, because their cut is so large. I mean, that's the thing that most people don't know is that the painting is $1 million. Well, the artist, you know, gets sometimes less than half.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, we kind of veered off.
That's okay. That's good. That's good. I love it.
Side road about art, but I'll send you, Tom, a few things about Myra, because I think, especially since you know about Hans Hoffman, and their connection was really so close.
Well, and you know, I really love abstract expressionism. You know,
I do too.
Mark Rothko is really my favorite, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And,
Myron's representative, was, and I just blanked on his name. The Oil and Steel Gallery was Rothko's. They shared the same, representative. So his Rothko's work, Oil and Steel, and the guy's name, for the life of me, I can't remember. Tom, I'll remember it, but it's great. And it's funny how kind of the way it ebbs and flows too, and the popularity of an artist. You know, who collects Myron is Tom Ford, you know, the designer. And I had kind of forgotten about that until I saw a movie called A Single Man, which I think that's the name of it, that Tom Ford directed. And Julianne Moore is the lead actress in the film. And in her house, in her character's house in the movie, I thought, that looks so familiar. Well, it was Myron's works. Two of his paintings were in this fantastic kind of mid-century house. And I thought to myself, well, that's good. That's good. that association. And 'cause, you know, look, the buzz on any artist only helps, you know, you got to keep the buzz going no matter what.
Absolutely.
So what got you into the recovery field?
What?
By the way, I want to add before you answer that, and this is completely out of left field, to join the Carpenters Union is a big deal. So that's great to get into that union. Isn't that like a huge deal? Like you have to, I go through all kinds of hoops they don't just give those slots away.
I mean, no, they don't. And it's probably more competitive in places like New York. I grew up in Indiana and, you know, in a really blue collar town.
What town?
It's called Kokomo.
Oh, I know Kokomo. One of my favorite towns of all time is actually in Indiana and it's Columbus, Indiana. Do you know it?
I do know it, but, not well.
You should go there. It's the architecture in that town is unbelievable.
I have been there. It's been a long time.
It's the architecture in this little Indiana town outside of Indianapolis is unbelievable. They have a house there called the Miller House by the Miller family. It is this world-renowned house that every architect in the world studies, designed by Saarinen.
Okay.
Saarinen. And it's phenomenal. It's absolutely, and it's one of the many, architectural masterpieces in this little.
I didn't know that. You know, I mean, there are some pretty interesting things about Indiana if you get around a little bit. You know, there was a Shaker community there at one time and, you know, lots of little interesting stuff, but,
those big cows in the airport. Those big.
yeah.
Oh,
well,
I know. Right?
Well, my hometown's known for the big cow in the park that's stuffed that supposedly the biggest steer in the world lived there at one time, and that's we kind of
stuff like a taxidermy cow. Like,
yes, yeah. Real? Oh, it's enormous. I mean, it's like it's taller than you. You know, so yeah,
the Herman Munster of cow.
Yeah, we natives joke about Old Ben. It was his name, Old Ben. That, and there's this enormous tree stump that's in the park that, you know, supposedly the world's largest sycamore stump. So yeah, it's not a huge town, but 50,000 people maybe,
But the cows are big and the tree stumps are huge.
The cows, at least at one time, the cows and the tree stumps were really
and
big.
And it's really stuffed.
Yes.
And it's there in the, is it
in the city park? There's a little section of the city park where they have it on display in a covered building behind glass. And then nearby.
I was going to say that they don't leave Big Ben or whatever out there in the elements.
No, not at all.
I mean, I don't want that.
Now the sycamore stump actually grew somewhere else, but they moved it there. It's huge. I mean, you can walk into it. It's probably similar to a redwood. I haven't been there. I'd love to go there someday, but
the redwood forest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, so I grew up in this blue collar town, and I had a brother who was in construction, and his best friend owned a contracting company. And, you know, I got out of high school, and there's lots of rabbit holes we could go down with this, but long story short, they needed help. I wanted to make better money. I was going to take a year off before I went to school. And so I started working at this construction company. As a general laborer, I did a lot of painting and stuff like that. And then eventually, they helped me get into the carpenters union. There's a test that you have to take. And then there's a training program, which includes classroom work and what they call skill blocks, which, you know, basically, you know, you might have to build like a miniature house inside this workshop. And the first project that they made everyone do, and I'm sure this is pretty universal, but you had to build a set of saw horses with only hand tools. And, you know, that might not sound that complicated, but they were, essentially, you know, a sawhorse is kind of like the structure of a roof. Right. And, you know, it had all these compound miters that are hard to really, really difficult to cut with a handsaw.
Right.
And it was really a way to weed people out to see if you were really going to, you know, if you're really interested,
that you could
to
do
it
with the precision that you need to make that miter
edge
or corner or whatever the right term is. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was pretty difficult, but, so I did that, and, I was, you know, in the fourth year of a 4-year apprenticeship, and you know, I grew up.
That's how long they are. The apprenticeships are four years for.
Yeah, carpenter. To become a journeyman carpenter. Yes,
and you're working obviously the whole time. I mean, you're out there working and making money.
The way it worked in our local union was that you went away to this school for a week a quarter instead of doing it at night. They had you go away for a week, a quarter, and, you know, there's lots of classroom work, and then you had to do stuff in the workshop too. So I got into my fourth year of that, and, you know, I drank as a kid, you know, I drank a lot and, you know, got myself into trouble.
You said, you know, you had a brother that was also, in construction, I'm assuming a carpenter.
He was an electrician.
You're one of how many kids?
I'm the youngest of eight kids.
What?
Yes. Youngest of eight. but you know, there's alcoholism, all through my family tree. both sides, you know? So yeah, I ended up, if it's a gene, I got the gene. And, so by the time I was 23 years old, I had drank enough to last me a lifetime.
And more than your contemporaries, your buddies that were also electricians and carpenters, and your brother and his friends, and all of you guys, you were drinking, you were out drinking those guys.
I mean, there were some scattered alcoholics here and there, but I was definitely an alcoholic, and
you were really committed to it. You were really,
well, you know, it's funny because I wouldn't really say that, you know, and this is part of the reason why, I'm doing this show called The Path to Authenticity, because I'm not a carpenter, you know, I'm not, but you know, I grew up in this environment where, you know, I didn't have a lot of ego strength. I didn't have a lot of self-esteem.
Wait. I know where you're going, and I agree with you. And I think that it is a journey for everyone, of self-discovery. And the reason I say that is that, you know, as a young man, a lot of this probably came out of necessity. You know, you were out of high school, so you needed to work. You didn't want to go to school right away, to college. So you thought your brother was already working, right? One of the eight. How many boys, how many girls?
Well, five sisters and two brothers. Yeah.
Wow. So, you know, your brother, kind of, you know, helping you get into this paying, job, right?
Yes,
and
into
what could be a career. And listen, a career in carpentry, a lot of people have built great lives from that. So,
well, yeah.
I'm kind of swaying all over here, but what I'm trying to say is I don't think any of us really begin where we want to be.
No.
Our authentic self is going to be. And I think, don't you think though, that those first chapters that we kind of have to live through are important?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Isn't it kind of good not to have things work out exactly as we dreamt? And you know?
Well, I definitely wouldn't be here now doing what I'm doing if I hadn't gone through everything I've gone through. Excuse me. But, you know, the bottom line is that there were other things that I wanted to do. And, you know, the louder voices of people around me that were encouraging me to do things were encouraging me to, like, yeah, you're not going to make any money writing. Why don't you get a trade? You know, because I had been in a really strong journalism program at my high school, and I had done really well at it. And I had teachers encouraging me to pursue that. And I kind of knew I wanted to write, but I wasn't entirely sure. At one point, I thought I wanted to be in radio, which is part of the reason why I'm doing this now. But what ended up happening is I didn't go away to school. I ended up, you know, working full time. I just always kind of had this idea in my head as a kid that all I really needed was a full time job, and I was going to drink beer all the time and have barbecues on weekends, and I was going to have a good looking wife, and like everything was going to work out.
Well, had you grown up around, had that been the example set for you by parents and then friends of parents and cousins?
I mean, it was kind of that sort of environment. It was a factory town and people made good money. And so, you know, I didn't have huge aspirations. And, you know, there was no one saying, nah, you got to shoot higher than that. So,
or people that understood your aspirations,
right,
and could get behind it to support them. Because if you have folks around you that love you, as I know your parents, loved you and aunts and uncles and everyone else, you're talking about being a writer, if they don't know anything about that, that would be fearful. That would make them a little scared. Like,
and that's basically what.
How's he going to make money? How's he going to survive? We don't know it. It's scary.
They couldn't visualize it, and it seemed like a completely foreign world to them. And you know, so long story short, I just kind of let all that go, and then I finally did start going to school part time and worked full time as a carpenter. And then eventually the last couple of years, I got a contract with the local newspaper and I was covering high school sports and actually doing pretty well with that on the weekends.
But wait, how did that happen? You don't just get a contract. You must have gone in there and you must have made a case for yourself with the either the sports editor or the general manager of the paper.
I'll tell you. No, not exactly. Not exactly. I had this teacher in high school. His name was John Snyder, and he was incredible. Just a really great guy, and he believed in me. And I had him for my sophomore year, I had him for a journalism class that was primarily focused on news writing. And I just, you know, I'm someone that I never have really agonized too much over writing like a lot of people do. It's just, especially when it's, you know, news writing, inverted pyramid. I mean, it's formulaic. It's like you have the pieces, you put it together, and that's it. You know, you get your quotes.
Where did you learn that? You learned that from
I learned that stuff in high school. And so I took this class at the beginning of my sophomore year, and my high school had a radio station, and I was on it my sophomore year. And so at the end of my sophomore year, I was dating this girl and we were walking around the school and she wanted to be on the yearbook staff. And so she went to Snyder's classroom and, cause that's where she needed to apply. So she went there to grab an application and he's standing outside his classroom door in between classes. And, he sees me and he grabs me by the arm. And he drags me into his classroom. I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "You're going to be a sports writer." And I said, "No."
Now, how did he know?
That
was the right call. That you could do it, and that you would have the confidence to do it. And what did he see?
Well, you know, it was a class.
You must have revealed something other than I can write. You must have revealed this, kind of young ambition.
I don't know.
Without even knowing it.
Maybe, but, the only thing I can think of is, a lot of people don't realize this about news writing, but a lot of it's done on the spot. I mean, your deadline is like right now. So this class, my sophomore year in high school, it's not like he gave us homework assignments for writing. We did it right then, you know? And I think he felt like the quality was good enough that I will say one thing that I had an advanced journalism class a couple years later when I was a senior and that woman really encouraged me a lot too. Her name was Ann Bingaman. But one of the things she said to me one time is, there are never any mistakes in your writing. You never make a grammatical error. You're a senior in high school. Nobody, I definitely had the form and structure down, and I learned how to use active verbs.
Well, I think more than that. I think you also have an ear. You must have an ear.
Well, they liked me.
Do you know what I mean?
I think
you have a natural ear. You speak well. I mean, I've noticed that from the get go. Tom, but I think as a kid, as a young guy, before high school even began, you were listening to how, sentence structure, not just reading it, but listening to it. And that's really how becoming a great writer begins, is having that ear and not just,
Well, and I think some people,
rules of grammar,
but, right. Right. No, it's beyond that. I mean, I won't, you know, I love words. I do. I love words and I love the cadence of certain sentences and, you know, like, I really love like, Hemingway, the cadence of his sentences. And, you know, there's just a style that, you know, I kind of have a feel for that kind of stuff, I guess. Right. I do. And, I had that experience in high school. And a couple years later, when I'm doing this construction job over the summer, I was working inside this bank that our company was remodeling, and I was painting. And outside, I see Snyder walk by. And I run out and say hello to him and see what he's doing. He was on his lunch break. That year in Indiana, they had all the high school journalism teachers do internships at local newspapers, and they'd spend a week in each department. And that week, he was in the sports department, and he walked back by at the end of the day with a business card of the sports editor, and he came into this job site and he gave it to me and said, call this guy.
Wow.
And I did. And, you know, it's a small town. His wife was my sister's middle school English teacher. She had did babysitting for his kids. So I had been to this house before, but we didn't really know each other. You know, I knew his kids. But as it turned out, this guy, his name's Dave Kitchell, and he was Indiana Sports Writer of the Year multiple times. And, I can't remember what year it was, the Olympics in Atlanta. I want to say it was 92. Maybe, but that year, the Associated Press chose 12 news writers, sports writers from around the country to cover the Olympics for the AP, and he was one of those guys. So this was like, he was really a good sports writer. And so he started training me, and I'll never forget. You know, one of the things he said to me that I still use, I said it to my son a couple weeks ago. We were talking about writing, and he said to me the first time I met with him, you know, a lot of writers try to flower their work with adjectives, but it's really in the verbs. And, you know, it's funny because he chose a great verb he used flower as a verb in that case. Right. And so it was really easy to remember. But you know, really what happened is,
he's right, by the way. He's
absolutely. Yeah. And that was a lesson I had already learned by the time I got
it
to
applies
him.
To far more than writing.
Yes. But, so it got to the point after not very long, once I got the routine down, of keeping stats and interviewing and all that stuff, that, on weekend nights, football, basketball, the editor would generally cover one of the nights, the best game, and the assistant editor would do the other night. And it got to the point where I pretty much had the second story every time they gave me an assignment. So
were you having to take their own photos too, or did you?
No, there weren't photos. Once in a while, they'd send a photographer to take some photos, but right. I would have to keep stats and then interview usually only the winning coach. Sometimes if I had time, I would try to get in something from some of the players or the losing coach. And then I'd go back to the paper and I'd write, you know, and, yeah. So it went well for me, you know, I did well with it, but it was
and like, you were good with the, you were good with the pressure.
Yeah.
That timeline, it doesn't wait. And the clock is ticking.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can't overthink too much.
No.
Did you play sports?
I played baseball. I played a lot of baseball, a little bit of football, tiny bit of basketball, but I was a baseball player in a basketball state, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, what ended up happening is that I was really miserable in my job as a carpenter. I was unhappy. You know, my life wasn't going the way that I wanted it to go by the time I was 19, 20 years old. And I started to like self-medicate with alcohol. Really? That's what I did. Right. I just went into a depression and it escalated over time. It got worse and worse to the point where, you know, it might sound a little dramatic, but I came pretty close to drinking myself to death. And I had a sister who,
because you were drinking every day.
I was a binge drinker.
Could you drink on job sites?
No, I didn't do that. I would manage it around work and I would go periods without it. But when I drank, I drank, and there was no telling when I was going to stop. I lost control. Right. Once I drank, I had no control.
And you were drinking hard liquor, or
the above,
just tons of
all the whatever.
Whatever.
Toward the end, it was a lot of whiskey and stuff like that because I wanted to get there fast, you know. But
you had drinkers around you. So you were able to get away with a lot of this without too much alarm because it was what guys did.
Yeah, absolutely.
In your peer group and family and
yeah.
So it wasn't like this, you know.
No, it was a hard, it was a party in town too, you know. I mean, it was, and it was, you know, it was a family, you know, and I don't say this.
Did you know that it was different than that? Did you know in your heart of hearts that it was, that you were drinking differently than your
when you can't stop, that's right. The most frightening experience that I've ever had. I mean, there were times, honestly, John, when I've held a bottle in my hand and I couldn't not drink.
Right.
And you know, you hear stories from alcoholics, if you're in this world, about how, you know, their car kind of drove itself to the liquor store. I mean,
right.
You know, it was in control. It really was. Right. And I couldn't stop. I had to be stopped. And, you know, I had a sister who helped me get into a program down here in Florida. It ended up culminating in an arrest. I got arrested for public intoxication, basically because I wouldn't stay in the hospital. And my parents were told not to take me back home. That I blew a 3.9 like an hour after my last drink. And that's pretty high. I've only heard a couple different people who ever.
And you were how old at the time?
23.
Wow.
23. So it just so happened, I ended up in a Hazelden program down here. There was a Hazelden facility at the time. And once I was sober long enough to convince them to give me a job a couple years into it, you know, I had people encouraging me to try to be a counselor. So I decided to at least.
Let me fill in a couple of blanks for me.
That okay.
I didn't get. So your Indiana is, you know, home plate for you.
Right.
Just circle back to baseball for a second. Just keep that, you know, the baseball illusion going. So Indiana's home plate. All this stuff happens in Indiana. All of
right.
this. Good and bad stuff happen. Good stuff meaning that you find a voice in journalism and in sports journalism, and you probably feel great about yourself when you're doing that, I
right.
would imagine. I'm
yes.
sure that there's a certain pride and the beginning of this self-actualization
yeah.
and feeling probably authentic. Authentically, you're beginning
right.
to feel authentically yourself in those moments. And then by the same time, we got the carpenter job that was not you felt like it was going to be a forever style trap.
You know, and that's where the immaturity came in, I think, because I felt stuck.
But there's something to be said for the thinking that, okay, I'm serving my, because there's a trajectory to that carpenter life. I mean, you serve your apprenticeship, right. You do all this schooling, you take your tests, you have to build this and that. So you're making these marks on this ladder that's going up and up. So I could see your young man's head thinking, wait, I'm in this carpenter game.
It kind of looked good on paper.
And it's a sure thing. I mean, writing is not a sure thing, but right. This carpenter thing is a sure thing. I'm guaranteed there's enough construction going on. There always will be.
Somebody's always going to need a plumber. That's the kind of stuff I would hear. You know, somebody's always going to need a plumber.
Precisely. Always going to need a plumber, or always going to need a funeral director.
Right.
And a grocery right. store, a plumber, right. and a funeral right. director. So in your head, you were probably thinking, wow, in a way this is good, but in a way it's a trap too, that I don't want to be limited in my life experience to just being, you know, a carpenter. And I'm assuming that's, you know, the drinking helped kind of cloak that. It was comforting in its own way for a while, and then until it quit working and became another noose around your neck. And then you went to, so I'm trying to get from Indiana to Florida. So your sister found a place for you in Florida to go for treatment because she recognized how bad the drinking had become.
Well, actually what happened, she had moved down here with a guy she married, about 10 or 12 years prior. She had her own issues, and she had gone to this place a year before I did. So she found recovery and got the bug and said, you know, I'm not going to watch my little brother die. I want him to have this gift.
The one thing about also the families like you're from, where there are so many children, that means that the age difference is so, you know, it's more dramatic than in my case, than one of four children. And there's only, I think, 7 years difference with us. But in your case, the age gap must be far more broad. These older siblings are kind of quasi parents.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Yeah. More like aunts. My sisters were probably most of them more like aunts. Yeah. My oldest sister is 23 years older than I am.
All right. So that's,
And my youngest sister is 6 years older than I am. So I, you know, I came pretty late.
Yeah.
So she helped me, and in my world, we call it, she 12-stepped me, you know, and
she was the only one in the family.
Yes.
That had gone through that
process. Yeah. There were other people who definitely could have. But she was the only one who had.
Who did it, right.
And it was, you know, having grown up around her, it seemed pretty remarkable that she could stop. And you know, I think the real favor that she did me, besides just giving me love, was she helped me see that there was hope, that I could actually be happy if I stopped. Right. Like life could be much better.
And it was within your grasp,
right?
She was part of you, one of you, and if she could do it was plausible,
Feasible. And also, it sounds a little more desirable than I would have thought, you know. So you know, I did it, and she was a huge help. It was great to have another family member, and I stayed. You know, obviously, I'm in West Palm Beach to this day. It's almost, you know, I'll celebrate 23 years this September, and it'll have been half of my life that I've been sober. Yeah. So,
that's congratulations.
Thank you. That, you know, 20 years, I was talking to somebody earlier. Once you get to 20 years, I mean, that feels like. There you go. Another episode in the books. Thanks for listening. You can learn more about the show and this episode's guest at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you enjoy this episode, please share it with someone. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every little bit helps. I want to thank the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. If you're so inclined, check out the Patreon community. As soon as I do these interviews, I upload them to Patreon, where the content is only available to patrons and for just a couple bucks a month. I usually post audio content there, exclusive audio content, probably 8 times a month, if not more. And as these new episodes are released, as soon as they're done, they're available to patrons. So sometimes that might be 2 weeks before an episode is released, or even longer. Usually it's a few days. Anyway, if you want to support the show, that's a great way to do it. So thanks again for investing your time. It's a big deal to me. Thank you for supporting me and supporting the show. I hope you keep coming back. Be nice.
That's our story. I hope you enjoyed the Punk Rock Opera. And we have one last piece of music for you. It goes like this.
Okay, go.
Feed a crowd, give them a rush.
Thank you.